Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's the usual pomp and circumstance of a state visit with the president of China in Washington today. There's talk of the balance of trade and human rights and currency valuation, and a whole lot of good old-fashioned business, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 19th of January, Wednesday today. Good to have you with us. You know, very little is left to chance in state visits like the one Hu Jintao is making to the United States this week. Who stands where, who says what gets signed are all mapped out weeks in advance. So the news that President Hu was bringing with him orders for $45 billion worth of stuff made in the USA wasn't entirely unexpected. And yes, right about now, I can hear you thinking, standard high-profile economic visit, right? A bunch of trophy deals and that's it? Far from it, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
What a difference 30 years makes. A generation ago, the China play was Western companies going there for cheap labor. Mike Morris worked for Pepsi in the early days, when Chinese workers were still figuring out the capitalism thing.
The state didn't actually pay you very much, pretended to pay you, and in return, labor pretended to work. I mean, that was the rules of engagement that we entered.
Today's new rule, China is exporting capital. In fact, more investment may be coming out of China now than going in.
It's already happening. The inflection is upon us.
Dan Rosen at the Rhodium Group consults to American multinationals.
We're starting to see extremely large volumes of Chinese direct investment flowing out into the world.
Large as in $4 billion flowing to the U.S. Translation, 10,000 jobs. The Chinese president this week is highlighting Chinese industrial companies buying and building factories here. And along the way, learning how Americans innovate.
What the Chinese are after is what they can't do. The engineering, designing new products that will break away from the pack like the iPod and iPad have.
An early pioneer is appliance maker Haier, as in H-A-I-E-R. 10 years ago, it opened a plant in South Carolina. Now it rules the U.S. compact fridge market. Dali Yang is with the University of Chicago.
Haier has done a great job. It has stayed away from the limelight and really made its presence felt in Walmart and other stores.
Not without growing pains, though. Clayton Duby at the University of Southern California recalls an early PR bungle over flags outside its factory. Haier had to lower its Chinese flag a bit.
So that the American flag was above the Chinese flag and above the South Carolinian flag. There are all sorts of small gestures you have to do in a community.
That might come harder to Chinese telecom titan Huawei. It's the world's number two maker of networking hardware, and its fastest growing market, North America. But to some, it's a security threat. Again, Dan Rosen.
Telecommunications is a sensitive sector in a way that hires dorm room bureau refrigerators are not so sensitive.
National security concerns helped kill Huawei's deals to supply AT&T and Sprint. The $30 billion Chinese company is privately owned. We don't know much about it.
This lack of transparency as to what the ultimate relationship is between the state and the corporate sector in China is starting to haunt Huawei.
Also coming to the U.S. market, Chinese video game companies. The American developer of this game, Mochi Media, was acquired last year by a Chinese company. In fact, several are now landing in the U.S. to go public, learn the U.S. market, and to hire, says USC's Clayton Duby.
These firms are eager to hire some of the 100,000 American-trained Chinese nationals who may want to remain in the United States.
In the world economy, that's what America is perceived to do well: develop talent and invent stuff. And it's the world's biggest consumer market. That should draw tens of billions of more Chinese dollars this decade. It's coming, ready or not. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
With the caveat that you can never really know why the market does anything, that's why we have to make the trades every day, after all, to see the prices actually rise or fall. But with that caveat in mind, it sure looked like the banks were the big drag on Wall Street today. Details, numbers, when we do them. President Obama will be hosting a state dinner for Chinese President Hu Jintao this evening. Once his guest is off to Chicago tomorrow, it's fair to suppose the president will turn his attention to another piece of business, the State of the Union, next week, Tuesday to be specific. The upcoming speech has commentator David Frum thinking back to his days as a White House speechwriter and offering this pep talk.
President Obama's speechwriters face a nasty problem as they prepare for the State of the Union address. On the one hand, of course, they will want to express empathy for the many Americans struggling with extreme economic difficulty. The writers will understandably flinch from anything that sounds complacent or self-congratulatory. On the other hand, the country is gripped by a bleak mood of anxiety and despair that threatens to become self-fulfilling. 60% say we are on the wrong track. A plurality of Americans say they expect life to be worse in the next generation than the last. Barely one-third say they expect the United States to remain the world's dominant economic power. Almost half cede that top spot to China. So this might be an appropriate moment for the president to remind Americans of the country's continuing strengths. The United States is the world's biggest economy, 3 times bigger than China. Americans remain the richest people on Earth, except for tiny economies whose statistics are distorted by huge energy earnings or banking inflows, like Qatar and Luxembourg. Think we're losing our technological edge? The United States files more patent applications than any country on Earth, twice as many as number two Japan, 10 times as many as South Korea, almost 20 times as many as China. Think we no longer make things? The United States is the world's 3rd largest exporter. We import more than we export, but half that deficit is accounted for by energy. And our single largest source of energy is Canada. If you were to conceive of the North American economy as an integrated unit, our international dependence becomes much less ominous. Troubles? Of course we have them. Strengths? We have many more. The State of the Union presents an occasion to summon those strengths to mind.
David Frum is the editor of Frum Forum. In a former life, as I mentioned, he was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Back next Wednesday in his regular slot, Robert Reich. Your views, whenever you like, go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. There's a great tendency in business, especially now in the middle of earnings season, to look ahead, to try to figure out the projections for next month or next quarter. When you do that, though, it's easy to lose track of the big picture, the really big picture. Daniel Altman says we ought to be looking years, even decades ahead. He teaches at New York University's Stern School of Business. And in his new book, Outrageous Fortunes, he makes some predictions about what the global economy might look like down the road and what it might take to prepare for that future. Daniel Altman, good to talk to you.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
I'm going to start a little bit sideways with some nuclear physics. You make reference to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in this book, and I should explain by way of saying, if you observe something, you are in theory going to change it, and you make that remark about observing the global economy, too.
That's right. I think that only by having some idea of where we're going under current conditions can we figure out what we need to do to change it. Just the action of looking at it is actually going to change the future for all of us.
I wanted to talk for a second about what you point out is the world's largest economy. It's not the United States. It's not China. It is, in fact, the European Union. It's been bailing out its member states right and left for the past year or so, is still, on the face of it, relatively stable. But you think it's going to break up sooner rather than later.
Yes, I did an analysis of the economies in the European Union and tried to look at what their long-term risks were and what their long-term potential to grow was. And what I saw was really remarkable. You could see four segments of European Union countries, some leaders, some laggards, some wild cards, and they seem to be going in different directions. So my conclusion is actually that the European Union won't necessarily abandon every piece of economic integration that it has now, but it's likely to head onto several tracks in terms of where it's going economically.
Along those lines, you talk a good deal about the rise of the rest, emerging markets and the obstacles and the trends that they're going to have to confront. What are you thinking is going to happen there?
I think there are some great opportunities for some emerging markets. I have a chapter all about where the new economic hubs are likely to arise, and it won't be in the classic places that are centers of commerce. It'll be more in places where people enjoy the lifestyle and they can interact with other young, talented individuals. But I also think that there are some risks for these emerging economies. For example, the wave of neocolonialism, where you see countries like China and Saudi Arabia buying up tracts of lands and resources in what tends to be poorer countries, these deals are probably going to work out badly in the long term for both sides.
The United States, of course, is still the world's biggest economy in absolute terms. It's got military strength. It's got the spirit of entrepreneurship. And yet you do lay out some factors that you think are going to be a problem for the United States in the near term future.
I think the United States, generally speaking, has some of the best economic fundamentals in the world. I know I sound a bit like John McCain in the worst days of the recession when I say that. But there are some problems. I think our immigration policy is deeply flawed, for example. It's not economically motivated at all. We are creating artificial situations in our industries where we may not be getting the people with the right skills.
The last item in your book is, to my mind, the most important, the political institutions that we have here and around the world. And you make the point that they are not ready or really able to make some of the decisions we need to make in the global economy.
Yeah, and it really does worry me. Without totally giving up our sovereignty, we can still at least talk about ways to create global governance mechanisms that would invest in the solutions to these global problems in a more strategic way. And I hope that domestically we'll consider lengthening the political cycle a little bit, because every 2 years is simply too short to get any politicians focused on long-term problems.
Daniel Altman's latest book is called Outrageous Fortunes. There's an excerpt from it on our book blog. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. Daniel, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Coming up, Atlantic City rolls the dice.
The convention market is becoming more and more attractive because we don't see that casual gaming customer coming back.
Get it? Rolls the dice, Atlantic City, gaming. Anyway, let's do the numbers. It's bad when you have to explain a joke, right? The Dow Industrials gave back a 10% today, 12 points closed at 11,825. The NASDAQ forfeited close to 1.5%, 40 points, 2725 at the bell. The S&P 500 reversed 1%, 13 points, ended things at 1281. Goldman Sachs took the shine off financial stocks after reporting a sharp drop in profit. Shares lost more than 4.5% today. Bank of America gave up more than 4%. J.P. Morgan Chase moved down 2.3%. Citigroup lost 0.8% today. On the tech front, Apple shifted down 0.5%. IBM kept up its post-earnings momentum with a 3.3% bump. Google unpacked 1.25%. Shares of Mosaic Company plunged more than 10% today after Cargill said it would sell its stake in the giant fertilizer producer. Cargill, which is privately held, supplies grain and meat to big food companies. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dipped to 3.33% today, repeating infinitely, I imagine. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses and professionals monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com.
By PBS, presenting a look at the cutting edge, like car parts made from mushrooms. Nova's Making Stuff, tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for December. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. And 30 years ago, on January 20, 1981, 52 U.S. citizens were released from Iran, ending the 444-day hostage crisis. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was another batch of banking profits out today, and with those reports, fresh signs of an improving economy. Both Wells Fargo and U.S. Bancorp posted higher fourth-quarter earnings this morning, thanks in part to making more money off loans. But those results, it should be said, were also a bit skewed, because now that the economy is generally on the rise, growing however slowly it is, banks aren't setting aside as much for losses as they used to just a couple of years ago. And while that can help with the bottom line, profits, that is, doesn't always hide the fact that the banks aren't bringing in as much money as they did before the recession. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
Banks are facing a challenging new world compared to the lofty numbers they were able to post before, let's just say, before reality set in. Eric Oja is a banking industry analyst at S&P Securities.
Revenues a few years ago were probably artificially inflated, so it's unfair, I think, to compare revenues now with revenues then.
Is that revenue ever going to come back?
Probably not.
Which is why today's headline that Wells Fargo posted a record profit doesn't tell the whole story.
The quality of earnings is not at all high.
That's another way of saying the banks can't keep this up if their traditional cash cows don't start coming home. Businesses remain reluctant to tap their bank credit lines, so loan fees and interest income are still lagging. And Celent analyst Bart Narter says retail banks face more challenges.
You have a whole bunch of new regulations that reduce revenue to banks.
For example, your bank used to be able to charge you $35 for that latte you mistakenly put on your debit card.
You go into overdraft, you pay $5 for the latte and $30 for the overdraft charge.
But not since banks were forced to get your permission to apply so-called overdraft protection. Other fees have been limited by regulators, too. So Narter says look for banks to focus on changing your behavior, say steering you toward an ATM rather than taking up the time of a teller in person.
Many banks are concluding that they aren't going to get the money back, and to increase profit, they're going to have to reduce costs or become more efficient.
There is an old-fashioned way of increasing a bank's cash flow, but like everything else about this slow-motion recovery, that's going to take time.
Fundamentally, to have a healthy banking industry, you need a healthy economy.
Narter says when the economy picks up, when people have jobs and can get mortgages, that will start generating more revenue for the banks. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The weather forecast for Chicago today was for a high of 24 degrees, snow showers or some kind of freezing precipitation predicted at some point. That only goes to validate one of aviation's great winter rules to live by: steer clear of O'Hare Airport. Chicago's main hub consistently ranks among the worst for delays, which is part of why a decade ago the city and the airlines who use that airport made a deal to update O'Hare. The basic plan was to improve the flow of passengers, add more runways and share the costs. And phase one is done. Phase two, you might say, is delayed. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
80% of the flights that go through O'Hare are run by United or American Airlines. But the two companies have a lot of other things going on. United is reeling from a merger with Continental. American is battling airfare websites. And both know Wall Street is watching them very closely, says aerospace analyst Ray Neidel.
Financially, right now, they're concerned about their next meal. And they're looking at every nook and cranny to see where they can economize.
Airlines at O'Hare agreed to pay $2 billion, the lion's share of the cost, for the next phase of airport expansion. But right now, that looks bad to investors. So American and United have sued the city of Chicago to block the next part of the project. Their argument is this.
Right now, there's plenty of room at O'Hare.
Joe Sweeterman studies transportation at DePaul University. He says air traffic is not increasing at the rate it was when the expansion plans were first made a decade ago. So United and American say the city shouldn't force them to move forward until growth is back on track.
We want triggers. We want milestones to be reached before, you know, we start spending the extra billions.
But the city wants to lock in contracts now, when construction costs are down because of the recession. The O'Hare project involves bulldozing neighborhoods, relocating thousands of residents, and moving a cemetery. City officials say if the airlines stall the project, it'll just cost more down the runway. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday. Time to go through the inbox.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Last week on the broadcast, Thursday to be specific, we devoted almost the entire program to the story of one house, Lot 354. We called it A Tale of America's Housing Meltdown. Our story hit a bit close to the bone for some. Lynn Horton of Worthington, Massachusetts, wrote to say that an interest-only loan, like the one in the story, cost her son his house.
That interest-only payment he needed to make every month eventually became a factor in a probable bankruptcy filing and loss of credit, and loss, most of all, of his self-esteem. He quit his real estate job. He lost his house and started from the bottom up without having to file for bankruptcy.
Jason Burke from Oakland, California, had a gripe with the story, the bit where a real estate agent said that the smartest people on the planet back during the housing boom believed that real estate prices were just never going to fall.
Sure, real estate agents have made huge commissions by hyping up prices, so for him it was pretty smart. But seriously, the smartest people on the planet were not telling us that it was only going to keep going up. Only the deluded or those with a financial interest in ever-rising prices, those paid in commissions on real estate transactions, kept telling us the market would keep going up.
We had Michelle Rhee, the former chancellor of the Washington, D.C. public school system, on yesterday. Yes, she said, she's Asian. No, she's not one of those tiger mothers who've been in the news the past week or so. But she does think that our habit of praising every student as a winner is actually a disservice to them. Michael Ellery is a high school history teacher from Wauwatosa, Wisconsin.
The mere prospect of having an honest conversation about a student's competitive weakness makes me shudder. I can almost hear the phones ringing with parent complaints that my administrator is paging me to have a conversation about my attitude.
If you want to talk to us about our attitude or about anything else on the broadcast, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. You can find links there as well to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. If you're looking for me, it's at Kai Rizdahl. Atlantic City, New Jersey is looking to break a four-year losing streak. Fewer gamblers are headed to that would-be Vegas by the sea, a slowdown only made worse by the recession and the financial crisis. Empty casinos and spare hotel rooms have tourism officials looking to attract a more conventional customer, as Joel Rose reports.
For the first 30 years of legalized gambling in Atlantic City, revenues only went up. They peaked at more than $5 billion in 2006. Since then, they've fallen by a quarter. Corey Morowitz is a gaming consultant in New Jersey.
Our days as a place where people have to go to get gambling are over.
New casinos in Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New York have seen to that. But the sudden decline in Atlantic City's gaming numbers does have a silver lining. For the first time, Atlantic City has lots of empty hotel rooms in the middle of the week. Perfect for conventions. On a recent Tuesday, hundreds of candy makers gathered at the Atlantic City Convention Center. Mike O'Connor of Asher's Chocolates shows me around his booth at the Philadelphia National Candy Gift and Gourmet Convention. The highlight is a chocolate Easter bunny that's bigger than my arm.
That's a big bunny.
That is a big bunny. It's a 25-pound bunny that retails for about $150. We have many retailers who buy that to make a statement in their store.
Despite the name, this semi-annual trade show has been held in Atlantic City for the last few years. The show's chairman, Francis Cox, says his conventioneers like it here.
Even if you don't want the gambling, you have a multiple choice of restaurants, series of hotels you can stay at so you're not locked into one. There's a lot to offer, even if you're not into gambling. You know, some of them do like to gamble, so they have that extra benefit.
As conventions go, this one isn't huge, with attendance in the low thousands. But this is exactly the kind of business Atlantic City officials need to attract. Governor Chris Christie has set a goal of growing the city's convention business by 30% in the next 5 years. Jeffrey Vassar is the president of the Atlantic City Convention and Visitors Authority.
What we need to do in Atlantic City is basically change from a gaming-centric customer to a convention and a leisure customer.
Back in the boom times, Vassar says casinos were more interested in filling their hotel rooms with gamblers than convention visitors.
Now that their rooms are emptier, the convention market is becoming more and more attractive because we don't see that casual gaming customer coming back.
So Vassar focuses on pitching Atlantic City's virtues to meeting planners, the restaurants, the beach, the shopping, and a growing slate of live entertainment options. Like this Lady Gaga show last year. Atlantic City tourism officials know they don't have enough hotel rooms or meeting space to compete with top-tier convention destinations like Las Vegas and Orlando, but they think Atlantic City can fill the rooms it does have with smaller regional conventions. That may not sound like a big deal, but gaming consultant Corey Morowitz says it could be critical to Atlantic City's future.
A lot's at stake here, because if we could drive higher occupancies and higher room rates in Atlantic City, you can bring these casinos back to profitability. If you do that, that could change the mindset of the financial community and really ignite investment in the city.
If that doesn't happen, Atlantic City's losing streak could just be starting. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today to follow up on Bob Moon's story about bank profits. Can't leave without mentioning the bank that everybody loves to hate. That'd be Goldman Sachs, of course. Goldman reported profits this morning, both quarterly and year over year. The numbers were down in both cases. And when the bank makes less money, so too do Goldman employees. Don't feel too bad for them, though. Average compensation last year, better than $430,000 if you have a Goldman Sachs business card. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave back 0.1%, that is 12 points. The Nasdaq forfeited close to 1.5%, 40 points. The S&P 500 back down 1%. 13 points. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, you want to fix the global economy? Try computer games.
That ability to organize large groups of people where everybody gets to contribute their skill is really important as we start to tackle planetary scale problems.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.